Welcome, gentle listener, to Still Dreaming, a podcast about existentialism and forever night. Forever Night was episodic, but this podcast kind of isn't. You may be best served starting at the beginning with the introduction and working your way forward. So with that, let's begin. Good evening, gentle listener. Boy, oh boy, do we have an episode tonight. Whew, this one's called Dead Issue, and it's number 12 of season 1. Now, Forever Night has good episodes, and it has bad episodes, and then it has Dead Issue. The first few episodes of the season have been uneven, but overall, through the first half of season one, I think the quality of storytelling has generally been getting better. The writing seems to be finding a rhythm, the actors seem to be settling into their characters, and the show is establishing a distinctive visual style. All good stuff for the most part, with a few missteps here and there. But this one melted my brain a little bit. To be clear, I'm not going to call it a totally bad episode. I was befuddled by some of the editing choices, and I do have a problem with some of the thematic choices, which I'll get into. But before we go any further, let's get grounded with some facts. Dead Issue was directed by Nicholas J. Gray, written by Lionel E. Siegel, and aired on October 6, 1992. The synopsis tells us this. Captain Stonetree becomes involved in a murder case involving his friend, a police inspector, and his wife, suspected of killing her lover in self-defense. While investigating the case, Nick remembers a time in 16th century Italy when he befriended a painter's abused model. So, a couple of things. I was really confused by this episode, by the pacing and the editing and the story choices, and I facepalmed a couple of times, and more than once I actually said out loud, "What the hell is happening?" So I feel like my usual approach of just describing the scenes as they occur isn't really going to work with this one, so I'm going to give more of a summary right here at the beginning, so that as we go along, you guys will know what's happening. So here's a more detailed synopsis. A woman named Lynn is a police inspector's wife. His name is Tony, and they're both really good friends with Captain Stonetree. Lynn is having an affair, which is not just an ordinary affair, but involves some kind of rough kinkiness to it as well. We find out that Tony knew about the affair and was kind of fine with it on one hand, but he's also using it to mentally and emotionally abuse Lynn. The affair takes a violent turn, and her lover, Charlie, is killed. The mystery, and I use that term loosely, is whether or not Lynn actually pulled the trigger or is taking the fall for Tony. The flashback storyline is where Nick is working as a painter's model with a young woman who he discovers has been molested and raped by the painter, who is, it is visually implied, is Hieronymus Bosch, painter of the Garden of Earthly Delights. And if you don't know who that is or what the painting is, I mean, don't worry about it. It doesn't really matter to the story. But I'll explain later why that struck me as just being such a bad choice. So yeah, I have a lot to fucking say, and my brain is melting. One of the themes in this episode is rape. The painter in the flashback, whether or not it's actually supposed to be Hieronymus Bosch, is a rapist. And I really feel this episode does not treat that with the importance it deserves. Further, women being gaslighted into accepting blame for men's violence is also a running theme in this episode. Not well handled, but a theme nonetheless. So we got heavy issues of misogyny and abuse and rape. So are we going to get a connection with Natalie talking about being a professional woman in a very, very male-dominated arena of law enforcement? Nope. Will Natalie voice a kind of feminine counterpoint of view for Nick to consider what he learns about the case? Nope. Is Natalie even in this episode? Barely. And I'll have a lot more to say about that at the end. So for our theory tonight, we're sticking with Simone de Beauvoir, which is fine by me since I love reading her writing. Because of how the issues involved in this episode are very distinctly gendered, I'll be looking primarily at Beauvoir's famous work, The Second Sex, from 1949. Previously, we've used The Ethics of Ambiguity. Beauvoir herself criticized that work later on for being too abstract. The Second Sex is her attempt to correct that by grounding her philosophical and political reflections in real, lived situations. But for now, let's get to the opening of the episode. We open at a port. It looks like a dock with private boats. A couple is making out on the docks. A different woman goes through the docks and walks into some kind of rock club on the waterfront. This is Lynn. There are strippers on the tables, lots of black leather. Lynn meets up with and makes out with some guy. We'll find out later his name is Charlie. We cut to them entering an apartment, and we have passionate, sexy time. The lovers start taking off their clothes. Charlie says he wants to do something new. But the woman wants to watch a video first, which struck me as being a little awkward, but fine, whatever. Charlie doesn't want to watch the video, and things start getting rough. He starts strangling her. She doesn't resist at first, and obviously this couple is into rough stuff, kinky stuff, but things quickly become violent. She breaks away from him and throws a vase at him and runs out of the room. He pleads for her to return, but then we see a close-up of a gun being fired, and he drops dead. And that's what takes us to the opening credits. So, the obvious cut from the wide shot of the room to a very close-up of the gun, where you can't see the hands or any part of the shooter, tells me that Lynn didn't pull the trigger. Not much of a mystery there. When we come back from the opening credits, Nick pulls up in his boat of a caddy while Skanky is fending off reporters, telling them no comment. Stone Tree arrives on scene, and we get the lowdown from Skanky. Lynn, who's an inspector's wife, was attacked. She shot in self-defense, which, of course, is not exactly what we saw in the opening. They go into the crime scene. Stone Tree talks to Lynn. I can't get over how much this room looks like a cheap hotel room, but I guess it's an apartment. The scene is quick and fairly well executed. Nick talks to a uniformed officer on the scene. The cop relays that the woman says she shot in self-defense, but keeps muttering to herself, "It's my fault, it's my fault." So, quick side note. There's a common trend in Forever Night, but really pretty much every police or crime drama, where we, the audience, see the crime of the week, more or less in its entirety, and then the heroes figure it out as the episode progresses. Usually what that means is that suspects and victims will give statements that the audience knows are false, but the characters don't know that right away. It's common enough in police shows, and honestly, it's something I've never really liked. I would prefer to unravel the mystery with the detectives rather than just waiting for them to catch up with my knowledge of the scene. Anyway, that's just personal preference and not really a commentary on the episode. It brings us to flashback time. Nick and a woman are there, and they are naked. They're there in front of a painter for some candlelit Renaissance studio, and the artist is apparently Hieronymus Bosch. And I make that statement because we see the painter at an easel in front of a painting which very clearly is the Garden of Earthly Delights. So, hard fucking stop. We're going to talk about this for a hot minute. I'm an art historian, by the way, and so I need to say a few things about this. I don't think they ever refer to the painter by name. If they do, I didn't pick up on it. Nick and the young woman in this scene are presumably nude, hidden from us by cloth, and the painter is working on what is clearly the Garden of Earthly Delights, painted by Dutch painter Hieronymus Bosch between 1495 and 1505. Now, the episode synopsis says that this is set in Italy in the 16th century. Okay, the time frame could work, but as far as I'm aware, Bosch never left his home country. So it couldn't be Italy if this is supposed to be Bosch. Now, Bosch was very influential as a painter, and his works were collected during his lifetime across Europe and were copied by others. Now, I have no idea of the provenance of Earthly Delights. I have no idea if the painting was in Italy and copied there. But if this were a painter copying a Bosch painting, or even copying a copy, which sometimes happened, why does he need nude models? Now, like I said, I am an art historian, but I am not a specialist in this field. So my knowledge on Bosch is limited, I admit. But here's what really disturbed me in this episode regarding the entire flashback timeline. As I told you about before, the painter in this flashback, we will find out, has raped the female model. Now, to my knowledge, we actually don't know much about Bosch's life, and certainly less about his personal actions outside of what works of art he completed. Is it possible he abused women? I mean, sure, I guess, in the way it's possible in any case, but as far as I know, Bosch is not known to have done any such thing. And as a historian, I am really hesitant to just make such an accusation. As I said, this is not my area of specialization. But what I want to point out with this is it's just sloppy, is what it is. Some prop master chose this particular painting to be the painting that is used to set the scene of this being a Renaissance studio. It's supposed to be in Italy, but it's not an Italian Renaissance painting. It's a Northern Renaissance painting. And it melted my brain, guys. It just kind of broke me a bit when this whole thing started getting unraveled. I am going to say a bit more about this, but let's get back to the episode before I completely derail. We go back to the crime scene. Skanky is harassing one of the fingerprint techs for some reason, probably because Skanky is an asshole. We cut to the station, and in Stone Tree's inexplicably unlit office, he's reminiscing over some photos of him and the inspector. In the detective's office area, Skanky has determined that the victim was a sleazy son of a bitch involved in sex trafficking and pornography and a bunch of other shitty stuff. Skanky gloats because he had a hunch about the victim that turned out to be right when Nick had dismissed it. He also gloats because Skanky is an asshole. As a little side note, I actually don't mind that Skanky is kind of a jerk like this, because first of all, it's focused on Nick, who is himself a bit swaggery sometimes, and two, I feel like the show has humanized Skanky enough at this point to accept that, yeah, he's a jerk sometimes, but that's not all he is. Nick goes to see Stone Tree, and we get that Stone Tree was very close to the inspector, Tony, and his wife, Lynn. Things get contentious. Stone Tree is very upset that Lynn was attacked, but Nick points out there are inconsistencies in her story. Stone Tree points out that the dead guy was a sleazebag, and that Lynn and Tony are, quote, good people. Nick insists that there are loose ends, though. Stone Tree tells Nick to drop it, eventually yelling at him and storming out. We cut to a screening room in the station where Skanky and a bunch of other cops are reviewing the videotape we saw in the opening scene, and yeah, it's porn. Nick walks in, breaking up the stag party, which, ugh, gross. You guys just hanging out at work, watching porn? I mean, I'm not judging them for watching porn, but watching porn on the clock with their coworkers? Ugh. Nick asks about some details on the forensics of the case. Skanky basically tells Nick to drop it, too. It's career suicide. Nick wants to follow up on the video connection, though. Skanky is adamant that this is going to be the end of their jobs, and he tells Nick that he's not going with him to further the investigation, and Skanky leaves him to follow up on a different case. Nick goes into an adult video store, and he wants to know who rented the video found at the crime scene. The owner manager doesn't want to cooperate with a cop at first, but it's implied that Nick uses a slight mind trick to get him to comply. And the manager tells some story about a woman bringing in the tape because she found it somewhere, and it all seemed a little convoluted to me, although it does pay off later. In a house with Tony and Stone Tree, the chief is encouraging Tony and Lynn to get away somewhere, go off to the Caribbean. Lynn is not in the scene. Tony says he's worried that his wife is going to have a nervous breakdown over the whole thing. Stone Tree says he's going to have a press conference the next day. So at this point, when I'm watching the episode for the first time, obviously something really fucking shady is going on. Lynn was into some kinky shit with the pornographer guy, Charlie. But now Charlie's dead, and she's taking the blame for his death. But the real mystery for me, when I'm watching it, is does Tony and Stone Tree know about the shady shit, or is this all on Lynn? Is Stone Tree trying to help cover up? Is Tony covering for his wife? And why haven't we seen Lynn in a while in the episode? We cut to the street, and the uniformed cop that Nick had talked to at the beginning of the episode catches up with Nick outside the video store. Skanky arrives to pick Nick up, but still wants nothing to do with this investigation. The cop tells Nick that neighbors saw Charlie in the apartment building before. That means he wasn't a stranger. Nick wants Skanky to get a warrant for the video store's records, and we cut back to the house from before. Lynn and Tony are packing up to go away. She's saying that if there's a preliminary hearing, she can come back for it on her own. Tony says that's a bad idea. How would it look if I wasn't there? The tone of voice for him is hard, unwavering. It's a bad guy voice. Nick lands in the lawn outside because, yeah, you know, no need to be sneaky or anything. He lurks around and listens in on their conversation. Tony is condemning his wife's, quote, abnormal, contemptible appetites, end quote, lamenting that she doesn't consider the ramifications of her actions. Lynn actually says she's not worthy of him and asks him why he doesn't just divorce her. Now make note of that. I'll have something to say about it later. He says, I love you. No matter what you do, Lynn, I'll always love you. I don't want you to love me, she screams and storms off. This relationship is strange. And the whole scene is just kind of weird. Lynn definitely comes across as anxious and scared. Tony is cold and his voice has a hard edge to it. It's not clear in the first watching of the episode, but in retrospect, I get that this is a clue about the abusiveness of their relationship. Flashback. This scene. Okay, it's mostly dialogue, so I'm going to give you a summary. The woman thinks she's a sinner for being a seductress. It's clear what she means is that she's a sinner because she is a woman. She's not actively trying to seduce anyone. And this is made clear, by the way, in the dialogue itself. It's stated outright. It's not my interpretation. Nick tries to reassure her that she's not a sinful person, but she insists. She says, society, the church, everyone teaches that women's bodies are the locus of sin and lust, and she sulks off as the painter comes in. And in casual conversation with Nick, the painter basically admits that he's been raping her on the regular. Oh my God! This is fucked up. This painter, who is, it's implied, is the Northern Renaissance great Hieronymus Bosch, comes into the storyline and just sort of casually says, oh my, what the fuck is this? This broke my brain. This is so fucked up. So, I've already mentioned the painting through which I identify this painter. The Garden of Earthly Delights, by the way, is a painting depicting all kinds of sensual, sexual, and forbidden pleasures. It's surreal, pornographic, in some cases comical, and others quite disturbing. So some prop person on the show decided that that was the painting they wanted. I suppose maybe for the sexual content. But it's such a distinctive image. It's such a recognizable image. And at this point in the episode, I'm really trying to put the pieces together. A woman in the Renaissance blaming herself for a man assaulting her, convinced of her own guilt. Lynn, in present time, blaming herself for the death of Charlie, her lover. And at this point, it's clear to me that Lynn definitely did not pull the trigger. She's covering for Tony. It makes me question then, what is Tony's role in the affair? Why was he there when Lynn was with Charlie? Was it a setup? Did Tony like to watch? What the fuck is going on? And to be clear, I'm not upset at an episode for trying to be complex. For sure, weave in different storylines, but dropping this bomb on us about the rape in the past, while we still haven't fully understood the dynamic between Lynn and Tony in the present timeline, it's just kind of startling to me. And it really doesn't do justice to the horrific things that are being implied here. So I want to take a moment here. Let's pause to bring in some Simone de Beauvoir. I've referenced her works in previous episodes, so I'm not going to reintroduce her. What we're seeing in this episode, especially in the flashback storyline, is an example of what Beauvoir would call the master-slave dialectic of misogynistic masculine ideology. Historically and culturally, male desires and subjectivities are seen as the normative state of being. Feminine lived experiences are defined through and for male dominance in an exploitive relationship. Her understanding of how women and men, and her analysis is pretty much centered on the heteronormative binary, exist in a subject and object relationship, which is based on her interpretation of a Hegelian dialectic, which, while I do find that fascinating, is getting us pretty far afield for me to describe in a podcast about vampire cops. So let me summarize. Culturally and historically, men are conditioned as the subject, the absolute universal norm. The other is a subordinate. Women are an other insofar as they are not men, and on this basis are denied the same level of subjectivity. I am way oversimplifying this, but that's the gist. If you're not too convinced by it, seriously, read her book. Her books, The Ethics of Ambiguity and The Second Sex. She's an amazing writer. So in this dichotomy, it becomes difficult for women to unify against their oppressors because of how women in heteronormative understandings are identify and self-identify with their oppressors and male compatriots. Women haven't the subjective authority to identify in unity with other women. Instead, racial, political, religious, and other non-gender factors divide women. Culturally and historically, women are conditioned to internalize their subordinated states. Thus, in this flashback timeline, we hear the young woman say that it was her fault that the painter raped her. She says it was her exposed ankle, the flutter of her hair. It was her very existence in a female body that caused the male painter to be overcome with lust. Notice how in this self-victim blaming, the male is absolved of guilt. His sexual desires are not his responsibility to control or understand. The male subject is, quote-unquote, allowed to act on impulse, even violently, with autonomy. And insofar as the act itself, rape, is considered morally repugnant, the blame for it is located squarely on the shoulders of the female other. The female body, in such a reckoning, is merely an object that stimulates a response from the male. This kind of misogynistic worldview utterly denies the individual subjectivity of women, positioning them as a less than human, less than real subjects. This denial of the subjectivity of others is at the root of oppression, not just of women, but all oppression, and is, if you recall from our discussion of the ethics of ambiguity for de Beauvoir, the definition of evil. Back in the present time, Nick flies off. We're back at the crime scene, and this confused me at first. The murder happened at an apartment rented by Lynn, but many of the scenes are in her and Tony's house, a different location. Nick discovers bullet holes from the shooting, which forensics had previously not found. We cut to the station, and the officer that spoke to Nick before leaves his report on Nick's desk. Skanky is at his desk, and Natalie is also there. She's worried, like Skanky, about Nick pushing this investigation. But surely Natalie has different motivations for her concerns. Skanky is worried about his friend's career. Natalie, knowing that Nick is a vampire and that his job is a part of his front, is probably more concerned about Nick losing his job and how that will mean he has to leave Toronto and pick up a new life somewhere else. I mean, Nick cares about serving society, righting wrongs, and all of that, but he doesn't care about his career. His job is security, the way a normal person would need to. Nick arrives and goes to Stonetree's office. He presents the reports about Charlie being in the apartment building before, and that he found the bullets in a place that contradicts Lynn's story. Stonetree is furious. Skanky and Nat talk to Nick in the office area. Skanky is a jerk and says Nick will be demoted to traffic cop. But then we find out Stonetree is going to have Lynn come in and give another statement. Validation? We cut to the interrogation room, and Lynn is giving this statement. She's coming clean about having a consensual relationship with Charlie. It's truthful up through the point where he's strangling her, but she says that she shot him. Flashback. Nick is interrogating the young woman model, basically asking her if she resisted the painter who had previously admitted to raping her. And Nick is rough with her, physically. He asks her questions, and it's really uncomfortable to watch. But I wonder if that's supposed to be a nod to the fact that women are often, historically and in the present, blamed for being victims of rape. She's adamant that she did resist, and Nick tries to use that knowledge to reassure her that what happened was not a seduction, no matter what the painter tries to tell her. And for fuck's sakes, I don't really get what this scene was supposed to give us. But here we see a woman denying her own autonomy to justify the violence inflicted upon her. And here's Nick, our hero, questioning her. What were you wearing? What did you say to him? Did you resist? Only when she has answered the questions to his satisfaction does he grant her subjectivity. It wasn't your fault, he says. As the male subject, he grants absolution to female object as victim. Fuck. Fuckity, fuck, fuck. I had no idea this episode was going to be so goddamned heavy, folks. Ugh. Back in the present timeline, Nick talks about which way Charlie was facing when Lynn shot him. Lynn says she doesn't remember. Back out in the office area, Natalie is sitting at Nick's desk, and she's talking to him and Donnie. So what's changed, she asks. Before, Lynn said she shot Charlie in self-defense. Now she says she knows him, but she still killed him in self-defense. So what's changed? Nick says, now I know for sure she didn't pull the trigger. We cut to a commercial break, and when we return, we're at the lair, where Nick and Natalie are resuming their conversation. He explains that the shots had to be fired by a taller person standing in a different spot than where Lynn would have been. They're talking about Lynn and her penchant for heaping blame upon herself, and Natalie makes a comment about how a lot of women do that. And I wish the episode would have elaborated on that some more. You know, how abusers often convince their victims that they deserve how they're treated. But instead, Natalie goes to fix Nick a veggie drink. Flashback. The woman is still taking blame for her rape, saying that even though she wasn't trying to seduce the painter, she feels like it must have been her fault. And yes, it's the internalization of the female as object paradigm that I described before. Back in the present, Nick reluctantly drinks Nat's concoction. We cut to the Raven, and Nick sees Jeanette. Jeanette knows Charlie. She knows him as being a lowlife, which there seems to be quite a crossover of lowlifes who come to the Raven. One of Charlie's associates is currently at the club, conveniently, and looky here, it's the manager of the porno video store from earlier. Nick pulls him out of the club. Back at the station, in an interrogation room, with the manager guy, Skanky and Nick. The video was rented by Lynn, but is what the manager says, but now his lawyer has arrived. Flashback. The young woman has killed herself. The painter comes in and is a massive douchebag about it. And at first I wonder if Nick is going to kill him, but he doesn't. And while a part of me certainly wanted Nick to tear his goddamn throat out, certainly I'm kind of glad they didn't go that route. It's unsatisfying. An innocent person was attacked, killed herself under the crushing weight of that trauma, and the offender gets off clean, without the tiniest bit of remorse or self-reflection. It's unsatisfying because it smacks of the real world. Back in the present time, Nick is at Lynn's house and he wants to talk to her, but she's nervous and anxious and closes the door on him. Back at the station, the manager is making a statement. The lowdown is this. The inspector, Tony, is the one who rented the porno video and then paid off the video shop guy to say it was Lynn. Stonetree hears all this, is visibly upset, and leaves. We cut to the inspector's house. Stonetree is there, confronting Lynn about how she was not the one who killed Charlie. She was having an affair with Charlie. She wants to take blame for Charlie's death. Stonetree was trying to talk her into admitting the truth. Back at the station, Nat and Nick are talking when Skanky calls and informs Nick of what's going on. Back at the inspector's place, Tony arrives. Stonetree confronts Tony, tries to get a peaceful resolution to the situation by having him turn himself in. Tony responds to this by hitting Stonetree over the head and knocking him out cold. Tony tells Lynn to drive Stonetree's car to the beach while he has Stonetree loaded into a van. All right, this entire ending bit, like the last 10 minutes of the episode, was just kind of bonkers. It was moving so fast. I put my computer down and stopped taking notes just to watch it because I was so confused. So I'm going to try to just summarize. I found the editing really confusing, and as I was not sure what was happening where. I'll say that the cutting back and forth between multiple locations did give the ending of the episode a lot of tension, which is generally a good thing. So this is what happens. Tony takes Stonetree to some location, some kind of warehouse. Lynn is driving Stonetree's car, but she has a mental breakdown and is found by the police. She eventually tells Nick and Skanky where she thinks Tony is going. There's a confrontation at the warehouse. Stonetree is shot in the leg, but not seriously. Tony is arrested. The takeaway given us in dramatic dialogue between Stonetree and Tony is this. Lynn was having an affair. Tony knew that she was having an affair. Tony was basically controlling and emotionally abusive to Lynn, using the affair as leverage to emotionally break her. After shooting the captain, Tony is taken into custody. And God damn it, my head was spinning after all of that. As in the episode overall, it's not necessarily that any one part of this was bad, but it was really fast. The editing was quick and a bit muddled. I mean, the acting was fine, the dialogue was overdramatic, and it was just a rush to the ending. And suddenly, we're at wrap-up time. In the epilogue, the precinct is having some kind of softball picnic outing. It goes late into the night, so Nick ends up going there to have some dialogue with Stonetree and Natalie that wraps things up nicely for us. He makes some comment to Natalie about how much things for women tragically have not changed very much. Natalie comes back that that's not totally true. Things are much better for women around the world. So Nick is both wrong and right. And then, guys, they kiss. Like an actual kiss on the lips. And then the episode is over. Whoa. This episode. Confusing, unexpectedly heavy, and disappointing that such important and serious themes like rape and abuse were not treated with a bit more gravitas. So when Nick says that things for women haven't changed much, Natalie counters Nick by saying basically, it's not that bad, we've come a long way, baby. Okay. Let's just talk about that for a moment. So obviously things are socially not as bad for women in the 20th century as it was in the Middle Ages, for sure. Although, I mean, it kind of a low bar, don't you think? So Natalie's status as a doctor and respected professional in forensic science attests to the massive shifts that have occurred socially in regards to the role of women in the modern era. But Nat's quick and neat little dismissal just didn't sit well with me. And I think this is the reason why. Because the episode wasn't about women seeking success in professional careers or education. The episode was about emotional, physical, and sexual assault. It was about women being gaslighted and manipulated to accept blame for violence inflicted on them. Now, in our current day, women are still statistically much more likely to be abused and assaulted in these ways than men are, although I acknowledge this does happen to men as well. And I guess I need more acknowledgement of those facts, to accept the reality and the heaviness of that. Not that I expect Forever Night to have some sort of PSA or have a very special episode, but I don't know. Here's what I would have liked, ideally. More Natalie. The whole fucking investigation in this episode was Nick, Skanky, and Stone Tree. Total sausage fest. And while honestly that probably is indicative of the male-dominated field of law enforcement, but let's get Nat involved. Have her be the one who figures out the forensics about the bullets. Have her approach Lynn. Quietly, woman to woman, gain Lynn's trust. Maybe Nick actually at first just buys the idea that Lynn was the killer. Maybe it's Nat who has to get Nick to take Lynn's story seriously. Maybe Natalie unravels the years of mental abuse that Lynn has suffered at the hands of Tony, helps her find a voice, helps her gain just enough self-confidence to turn Tony in. Take this whole gaslighting, women being emotionally beaten down by their shithead husbands angle with the seriousness it deserves. The whole thing with the affair with Lynn and Charlie was a little strange to me. Not so much that there was an affair, as the idea that Charlie had to be such a sleazy guy wrapped up in pornography and sex trafficking. Now, like I mentioned before, I don't mind a story being complicated, and I certainly don't mind that Lynn is not portrayed as some kind of saint. Although, if we were taking the whole abuse angle more seriously, we could understand her choices with some more empathy. Given some lines of dialogue in the episode, I kind of got the impression that Lynn chose to have an affair with a guy like Charlie because she wanted to give Tony an excuse to divorce her, to make the divorce her fault, to take the blame, but possibly also to escape. The flashback in this episode, as is so often the case, was a little too much on the nose. Every episode, the flashback is basically an abbreviated version of the main story in a different time period, and that gets a little repetitive. Maybe make the connection less direct, more metaphorical. Another note, because Nick is the hero, he's usually, well, heroic. So he takes the woman's side in the story, although in a very uncomfortable and problematic way, as I described before. But eventually, he accepts her telling and is supportive of her feelings. And that's pretty progressive of him, isn't it? I'm just assuming that Nick, born sometime in the 1200s, probably had attitudes towards women and sexuality that were not radically different from the accepted norms of the day. Now that centuries of encountering people from all over the world would change his attitudes and challenge his cultural misogyny, that's a fantastic thing to illustrate. But much like my criticisms of Nick always being a little too gentle and compassionate, I have to believe at some point he wasn't. At some point his attitude would have been more like the painter's. So how did those attitudes change? If this incident with the model was a turning point for him, well, that just wasn't well illuminated. I don't know. I'm willing to accept that I'm missing the point. Maybe the point is that in the past, he was empathetic to the model, but unable to help her in a meaningful way. But now, in the present time, he can bring justice for Lynn and can provide her with opportunities to grow and heal. Maybe that's the point I was meant to take away from it. From the point of view of examining us through Simone de Beauvoir, Beauvoir holds very clearly that equality between the sexes is absolutely attainable, but it requires accomplishing many difficult things. Women must first understand their programming, their internalized inferiority, must recognize, and this is important for Beauvoir, that equality does not mean sameness. Women do not gain their status as subjects by mimicking masculinity. That's to be in bad faith. Beauvoir fully acknowledges sexual difference. Oppressive masculine ideology can be overcome by women finding solidarity with other women. Recognizing the challenged subjectivity of women of all classes, races, and culture, and joining in unity with them. It is for Beauvoir not the responsibility of men to give women equality, but for women to fully understand and accept their subjectivity, to reject their status as objects in this gendered binary. This idea is why I would have really preferred Natalie to have a stronger role in the episode. Maybe even she would initially have a negative reaction to Lynn's adultery. Maybe Natalie would have been very judgmental towards her. Only then uncovering Lynn's fragile mental state and connecting to her. As is so often the case, there was some real potential for powerful storytelling here that I felt just wasn't fully realized. So folks, this was a strange one. It was a complex story dealing with very serious issues, and while I don't think they really gave the issues the weight and seriousness they deserved, I still have to say the episode was good or not terrible. It's just, it was messy. It was really messy in the execution. So where does that take us for next time? Next week is episode 13 of season 1, called Father Figure. That title alone indicates many possibilities. Until then, gentle listener, thank you for joining me on Still Dreaming, an existential journey through our forever night. Do you want to connect with Still Dreaming? You can find us on Instagram at Still Dreaming Podcast and on Twitter at podcast_still. And we have a group on Facebook. Just look up Still Dreaming Podcast. Would you like to help support the show? Donation buttons can be found on our website, stilldreamingpodcast.wordpress.com. Let's pause for a word from our sponsor. Still Dreaming is a podcast hosted and recorded by me in the newly revamped CERK Internet Radio Studio. Forever Night was produced for CBS by Glenn Warren Productions and Sony Pictures Television. All rights reserved.